Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. While one of my favorite musical groups of all time are the Beatles, they'd likely be my desert island band if I had to choose just one, I knew next to nothing about the insect variety. The Fab Four, of course, spelled their name with an A as in beat, but the real Beatles are even more successful than the lads from Liverpool, with hundreds of thousands of species worldwide living in practically every kind of environment. Our guest is one of the world's foremost experts on beetles, especially a type known as rove beetles. Entomologist Joseph Parker is the head of the Parker Lab in the Division of Biology and Biological Engineering at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. The rove beetles that Parker and his lab members are most interested in have adapted in amazing ways to coexist symbiotically with ants. They have a variety of mechanisms from chemical to behavioral and even anatomical to fool ants so that they can live in their colonies. It's a strange and fascinating world happening right beneath our feet in forest litter and soil. And Dr. Parker joins us now to talk about them. Joe Parker, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, before we get to beetles specifically, I'd like to know about, you know, as a kid growing up, were you interested in insects as a child or nature in general? What kind of came first for you?
Well, yeah, you can basically draw a line between seven-year-old me becoming completely obsessed with insects and what I'm doing now. So yes, very much so. Insects have been a central part of my entire life almost, and kind of very much embedded into my identity as a person, I would say. I got infatuated with cicadas when I was seven. I was walking through an exhibit in a museum in South Wales, which was where I'm from, a city called Swansea. And there was a really large tropical cicada with a pin in it. And, you know, during my 7 years on planet Earth, I just thought this is the single most fascinating object I've ever seen. And ever since then, I've just been fascinated by insects. It turns out that, you know, there aren't any cicadas that live in the UK. And so kind of gravitate towards the insects that are around you. And those are beetles. And so I would say starting about age 13 or so, I became very specialized on beetles, and then increasingly more specialized on certain kinds of beetles.
And where did you study entomology?
So I did my undergraduate degree at Imperial College London, and it was a zoology degree. And so there, you know, I kind of learned, it wasn't just entomology, it was, you know, the sort of foundations for what I do now, you know, molecular cell biology, evolutionary biology, ecology, you know, it was a wholesome zoology degree. But I, as an amateur, trained in entomology, you know, starting from a very, very early age. I was just a really, really serious amateur. And I would say I am still that person. It's just somehow, you know, Caltech pays the bills for me to study beetles, which I, you know, I feel very lucky about.
Well, let's get into beetles. Why beetles? What about beetles interested you, or you really wanted to devote your professional career to them?
Well, for me, biology is a very aesthetic thing, and nothing's more beautiful than the diversity of beetles. There's about 400,000 known beetle species, and there's probably, you know, a few million on planet Earth, including the ones that we haven't discovered yet. And they're just omnipresent organisms. They're everywhere. And if you take an interest in insects, one of the things that you'll routinely encounter are beetles, and you'll instantly be confronted with their, you know, almost endless diversity, morphological, behavioral, ecological diversity. And it soon becomes apparent to you as you start to become increasingly more interested in beetles that you can't study all of the beetles. So you end up picking a group that is, you know, a bit more interesting than the others to you. And for me, that was a group called the rove beetles, the family Staphylinidae. And they're not a trivial group of insects. There's 66,000 known species of rove beetles. That means it's the biggest family, not just within the Coleoptera, the beetles, but in the entire animal kingdom. Just to kind of put that into context, there's about 64,000 species of vertebrates. So you're talking about this one insect group that many times over surpasses the total diversity of all vertebrates. So if you take all of your fish, mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and put them all together, this one group of beetles is really trumping those. And again, when we think about the total diversity of species on Earth, including this, organisms that we haven't even discovered, you know, the rove beetle diversity is like incalculably huge. And so these are organisms that are ecologically very diverse. They've got into niches throughout the terrestrial biosphere. They reach peak abundance and diversity in tropical forests. But then there are species that live on subantarctic islands. There are species that live on transiently submerged coral reefs, right? They've got absolutely everywhere. There are species that live in like highly saline intertidal regions and rock pools. There are species that live on mammal fur, species that live in mammal dung. And then the species that I find most fascinating are the ones that have evolved to infiltrate social insect colonies. These are organisms called myrmecophiles or ant lovers. They're also termitophiles, species that have infiltrated termite colonies. And these are some of the most wonderfully specialized organisms on Earth. They've evolved these incredible behavioral, chemical, anatomical adaptations that enable them to effectively assimilate into the social fabric of these insect societies, gaining acceptance among the worker ants or termites. But they're social parasites. They're not providing anything to the colony. They are pilfering resources and are burdensome, but they're obligately dependent on the nest society. So if you take them out of the colony, they cannot feed themselves. They die very quickly. So they're kind of virtuoso symbiotic organisms that are really kind of the extremes of evolution.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit in more in detail. When you talk about a symbiotic relationship, I always think of that as, you know, both species benefit somehow. But it sounds like with the rove beetles that like to live with ants, the myrmecophiles, that's not true. They don't really provide anything for the ants.
Yes. So symbiosis is really an umbrella term that means living with another species of organism. And it encompasses a spectrum that ranges from mutualistic interactions where both sides benefit to parasitic interactions where it's very one-sided. And you could kind of argue in, I would say, many cases that what we often interpret as a mutualistic interaction between two species is actually really two-way parasitism. So both species is kind of, yeah, each species is exploiting the other one, and but the scales are a bit more balanced than in the case of a parasitic relationship.
Do you remember when you first got interested in this relationship between beetles and ants, how that came about?
Yeah, so I was in a swamp outside Cardiff in South Wales. I was 16, and I had a sweep net, and I was sweeping the vegetation, collecting beetles. And this minuscule rove beetle ended up in the bottom of my net. It's a species called Rybaxis laminata. And this thing is just 2 millimeters long. And it was a member of this group of rove beetles called the Salaphini. And to me, this was just this incredibly intricate small beetle walking around. And I just thought to myself, that's very beautiful. I've never collected one of this specific group of rove beetles before. And one of the first things you learn about this specific group of rove beetles is that they include some of these species, which are these stealth organisms, which infiltrate ant societies. And instantly, I just thought, that's absolutely incredible. You know, these things are sort of morphologically amazing species. Some of them have undergone, you know, degenerate evolution because they're so dependent on ant colonies. They've lost their eyes. Right, they can't see anymore. They've lost their wings because they can't disperse anymore because they're kind of locked inside these ant colonies. They're fed mouth to mouth by the ants. They've got these glandular structures on their bodies, which are secreting chemicals that manipulate ant behavior to prevent the ant being aggressive towards the beetle. And at that point, really, the rest of the insect world sort of fell away, became much less interesting than these beetles, these myrmecophiles. So I was 16 then, and yeah, I can reflect back on that initial experience of catching that beetle in that swamp when I was 16, you know, 9 o'clock at night. And on my office door now, I have a drawing of that species, Ribaxis laminata, just to kind of connect me back to that memory.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more in detail about the evolution of beetles with ants, because it's interesting to me to know that, you know, this had to take place over many millions of years to have all of these adaptations to live with the ants. Can you talk a bit about, you know, how you study that evolutionary history of the species you're in, you know, watching interact like that?
Yes. So there's one group of rove beetles called the Aliocarinae. Again, you don't have to remember the names, but this is the largest group of rove beetles. And this is the branch of the rove beetle tree of life that has undergone the highest frequency of evolutionary transitions from a kind of ecologically boring, predatory, free living existence where the beetles are just living down in the leaf litter and soil, feeding on other arthropods, into these remarkable specialized symbiotic myrmecophile species. And in this group of beetles, that transition has happened independently, probably several dozen to maybe 100 times. Okay, now that's really fascinating from the perspective of an evolutionary biologist, because what you have there are instances of evolutionary replication. These beetles have been kind of playing the same tape of life multiple times over. And each time they undergo this transition from free living to socially parasitic symbiont, aspects of their behavior, their chemical ecology, so the compounds they secrete on their body surfaces, their physiology, their life history, many of these things have all evolved in parallel in these different replicate evolutionary experiments. And that's very, very powerful if you're interested in trying to understand how new kinds of ecological relationships emerge. Okay, so across the, you know, tree of life, you know, there are the repeated evolution of highly specialized species interactions, symbioses that range from mutualism to parasitism, specialized predator-prey associations, and these kinds of things. You know, and this extends down to the microbial level, of course, as well as the multicellular organismal level. And these interactions between species often leave really no trace about how they initially evolved. So millions of years ago, what kickstarted the association between two species, right? What was the nascent form of this relationship that enabled these organisms to have these biologies that were so entwined with each other? That's a really fundamental question in evolutionary biology. And what you have here in these rove beetles is kind of the answer to that, because what's happened in these beetles is that many, many times over, they've transitioned from one non-symbiotic way of life to this symbiotic one. And the fact that it's happened many, many times over tells you that the species that haven't evolved this form of symbiosis have the potential to do so. They have the ingredients to make this evolutionary step towards dependency on another organism. And what we do in my lab is try and understand what those potentiating factors are and trace how these beetles have become modified to enable them to infiltrate ant colonies. Okay, and you have many replicate lineages where we can start to retrace the evolutionary steps to this form of symbiosis.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with entomologist Joseph Parker as we talk about the fascinating world of beetles. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with entomologist Joseph Parker, head of Caltech's Parker Lab, as we talk about his work unraveling the fascinatingly complex symbiotic relationships between beetles and ants. So, you know, when I think about the development of this relationship between your rove beetles and ants. It's fascinating because I think about, well, ant colonies are not an easy thing to infiltrate, you know, that they have their defense mechanisms. And I'm thinking to myself, how in the world do these beetles get in there without getting killed? Could you, you know, tell us a bit about, you know, what you've learned about that?
Yes. So ant colonies are really fortresses with like extreme social cohesion. Okay, ants are innately hostile towards intruder organisms. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, during the past 50 million years or so, ants have come to dominate the terrestrial biosphere. If you quantify the percentage of insects that are ants in fossil deposits, the past 50 million years or so, you can see this almost exponential rise of ants. And this must have driven a lot of insect life to extinction or, you know, really suppress the abundance and diversity of certain groups. But rove beetles seem to have really, you know, been an evolutionary success story in these modern ant-dominated ecosystems. And I think one of the reasons that they've been so successful is that before ants were really an ecological force to be reckoned with, they'd evolve really amazing chemical defense mechanisms. So at the tip of the abdomen, rove beetles have a very kind of atypical beetle morphology where, you know, they have the typical wing cases that most beetles have that cover the flight wings, but those wing cases are short. And the abdomen, you can see all of the abdominal segments and the abdomen is very flexible. And at the tip of the abdomen, these rove beetles have evolved a chemical defense gland that's really highly targetable at other species and has really nasty compounds that these beetles are able to secrete and to chemically defend themselves. So when ants swept to ecological dominance over the past 50 million years, these beetles are already equipped to create enemy-free space around themselves using their chemical defenses. So that was step one, the ability to coexist with ants, to get close to them in these ant-dominated ecosystems. I think that was very important. And then to make the move inside the colonies, you have to do a couple of things. You have to switch up your chemistry and you have to switch up your behavior. And I'll talk about the chemistry first. So we think that the fact that these beetles have this chemical defense gland enables them to facultatively, opportunistically break and enter ant colonies, keeping the ants at bay with their chemical weaponry. Because they're predatory, there's a huge payoff for getting inside an ant colony. These are very resource-rich environments. There's lots of brood, so the eggs and larvae are there. You know, that's like, you know, a supermarket for one of these rove beetles because all of this protein-rich food is just sitting there. And these beetles can get to it because they have this chemical defense strategy. And what this, we think, enables these beetles to do is become exposed to selection pressures inside the ant colony. And this has led to the repeated convergent evolution of this form of symbiosis right across this branch of the rove beetle tree. Okay, now this process of specialization on ant colonies, one of the first things that you absolutely have to do is gain your host's acceptance, right? And the ant colony is, you know, this cohesive entity. The ants in a given colony recognize each other as nest mates and they're not hostile towards each other. And the reason for that is they have chemicals on their body surface called cuticular hydrocarbons. These are compounds that they secrete onto the body surface. And when you see ants antennate each other, tapping each other with their antennae, you'll see that that's what they're trying to detect, these cuticular hydrocarbons, or we call them CHCs for short.
So that's how they figure out you're one of my ants.
Exactly. Now, what you can often find in these myrmecophile beetles is that they are chemical mimics of those cuticular hydrocarbons. Okay, so they gain the acceptance of the host colony by mimicking those chemicals. And one of the things that we've been exploring in my lab is how these beetles mechanistically at molecular level can produce the same compounds as these as their host ants. And what we found is actually they don't produce these compounds at all. What they've done is they've evolved to shut down their own ability to manufacture these cuticular hydrocarbons. And that transforms them into a chemical blank slate onto which they can paint the ant's own chemical profile. Okay, and what I mean by that is these beetles will physically climb up on top of an ant and use their feet to scoop up cuticular hydrocarbons from the ant's body surface and smear these chemicals over themselves. So they're basically basting themselves in the ant's CHCs. Then that enables them to acquire the colony's chemical identity. And once that happens, they're in. They're behaviorally accepted into the colony. They're treated like nestmates. They can go wherever they want. They can feed on the brood. They can be fed mouth to mouth because they are recognized as workers. So that chemical change is a real precondition to infiltrating the colony.
One of the things I saw a video on your website, which was really fascinating, was what you just talked about, where you have these ants, and sometimes they're like even dead ants, and the little beetles will climb on top of them immediately and start doing what you said, where they're, you could see them just smearing themselves with the ant goo, as I would think of it. And I found that fascinating. And you put like another, just a bug, some kind of bug in there, and the beetle had no interest in that whatsoever.
This is a really, this is the other side of the coin. So switching up your chemistry, okay, so, you know, turning yourself into this blank canvas onto which you can paint the hydrocarbons is really, really important. But the other thing is you have to evolve a behavioral attraction to ants, okay? That's the other thing that has to happen. So the free-living ancestral beetles that aren't symbiotic, if they bump into an ant, they'll chemically defend themselves and run in the absolute opposite direction. But what these myrmecophiles have done is kind of pull a 180. They are now seeking out ants and behaviorally interacting with them. And what we've discovered is those same chemicals on the ant's body surface, those cuticular hydrocarbons, they've taken on new meaning to these beetles. They are now attractive signals that indicate this is my host organism. I want to socially interact with you. Okay, so these beetles have evolved, you know, in this kind of interspecies form of social behavior where they'll seek out ants and behaviorally interact with them through this grooming behavior. And that enables them to assimilate into the colony by acquiring the CHC profile. And that's something we're very interested in studying at the level of the brain and neural circuitry. So it's the de novo evolution of this new form of social behavior that each one of these lineages of rove beetle has evolved.
So how do you go about studying the brain in your lab? Can you tell us about some of the techniques you use?
Yeah, so we use a range of genetic and ethological and computational methods to explore the behavior and neurobiology of these beetles. So, for example, we'll tether these beetles to little treadmills, okay, so they can trundle along on a, you know, kind of spherical ball, and then you can prod them with an ant. You can bring it in on a robotic arm and prod the beetle with an ant to see how it behaves. And in the case of a free-living beetle, as soon as it detects the ant with its antennae, it will flex its abdomen around and deploy its chemical defense gland. And then you can ask, what is the actual sensory information that the beetle is experiencing that causes it to classify the ant as a threatening organism, as a predator? And so then you can do things like extract the cuticular hydrocarbons off the body of the ant and apply them to a dummy object, like a, you know, a glass rod or something like that, and present that to the beetle to see if that can reconstitute the chemical defense behavior. And through these sorts of experiments, you can start to pin down the chemicals or the physical stimuli, the mechanical stimuli, and how these are transduced by the beetle's antennae that cause it to enact this chemical defense behavior. And then we can combine those sorts of experimental approaches with genetic approaches. So, for example, in these beetles, we've developed ways to mutate genes using a method called CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing. And so one of the things that we've done is mutate the an odorant receptor, co-receptor, which is a protein which is switched on in the beetle's antennae and is needed for the beetle to have a sense of smell. And when you mutate this receptor, the beetle has an incredibly impaired ability to detect ant chemicals, and you lose this behavioral interaction. And so this gives you an entry point into the beetle's nervous system. These are the molecular receptors in the beetle's antennae, which are detecting these chemical compounds and sending signals to the beetle's brain, where they're kind of evaluated. And the beetle decides whether or not this thing is something I want to chemically defend myself against, in the case of the free-living beetle, or I want to socially interact with and groom in the case of the symbiotic beetle. And we're probing increasingly further into the brain to understand how that evolutionary switch has happened.
And I also noticed that you had some studies where you put the ant chemicals on the beetles and they'll treat each other like they're ants.
So one of the interesting things that we found is that there are really kind of non-adaptive interactions between different lineages of these beetles. So inside a colony, sometimes you'll find multiple independent evolutionary lineages of these beetles coexisting with each other, right? And now each one of those beetles smells like an ant, and each one of those beetles is pretending to be an ant. So when you put those two beetle species together, each one is pretending to be an ant and is being duped by the other beetle's ant masquerade mechanism. So you find these really kind of hilarious interactions where, for example, one species is, beetle species is trying to groom another beetle species that smells like an ant, and that other beetle species is trying to, you know, secrete something from a chemical gland because it thinks that the beetle that's trying to groom it is an ant. And so you have to posit that there are mechanisms inside these colonies that, for example, spatially segregate these different beetles, okay, so that they have these viable strategies for making a living inside colonies of the same host ant. But those experiments are really important because it shows the sufficiency of these chemical cues, these cuticular hydrocarbons, for these beetles to determine that this thing that I'm facing, this other insect, is an ant that I want to interact with. So they have real kind of utility as a tool to do experiments with.
And could you tell us a bit about how you go about studying the chemistry of the ants and the beetles? How do you go about determining exactly what those chemical profiles are and then, you know, seeing how they match up?
So a lot of what we do is in the area of chemical ecology, and this means extracting these chemicals from these beetles or these ants. And in the case of the beetles, we study two facets of their chemistry, really. We study the cuticular hydrocarbons, these pheromone compounds that I've been talking about that are so kind of instrumental to the beetle assimilating into the inside the colony. And those are produced by specialized cells in the abdomen called oenocytes. And these are kind of chemical factories that are manufacturing these very long carbon chain chemicals, these hydrocarbons. And so we study at a kind of genetic and cell biological level how the beetle is synthesizing, how it's manufacturing these very, very long chain hydrocarbon compounds, the mechanisms that these myrmecophiles have evolved to shut down the production of these compounds when they infiltrate ant colonies. And one of the main tools that we use to study this aspect of the beetle's chemistry is gas chromatography mass spectrometry, which is, you know, a pretty old school chemical ecology method, but it works perfectly for these classes of compounds that these insects produce. So you can take an ant or a beetle and put it in a few microliters of a solvent called hexane, and then all of the cuticular hydrocarbons will shed off the body, and then you can separate those compounds based on their volatility by heating them up to 300 degrees Celsius and passing them through a helium column and then blasting each of those parts of the beetle or ant's chemical profile with electrons. And then based on the masses of the fragments that you produce by this electron blasting, you can basically determine what those compounds are. And this enables us to really kind of eavesdrop on the chemical language that these insects are using to communicate with each other.
That's fascinating. And then I'm curious about what you do out in the field, because you're located in Pasadena, and so you have all the hills of Southern California around there. Are there some particular ants that you are interested in studying that are local, that work good for your studies there?
Yeah, I mean, I have to give the founders of Caltech enormous credit for building the institute in Pasadena, because it turns out that in the Angeles National Forest, just north of campus, there's this evolutionary gold mine that we've been working on, where there are huge colonies of a specific ant species called the velvety tree ant, inside of which we've discovered multiple evolutionary lineages of these rove beetles. And this has really turned into an extension of my lab's work, this kind of natural system that lives on our doorstep. So really half the lab works on these velvety tree ant colonies and these lineages of beetles that have infiltrated these nests. And that's the system that we're using to understand the evolutionary integration of these beetles inside ant colonies. So we kind of pair field work, the collection of these beetles from nature, with a lot of laboratory work. And so you could think of it as a sort of farm to table way of doing science that, you know, goes the full, you know, research arc from collecting specimens in nature to analyzing their genetics and cell biology and chemical ecology and behavior in the lab. And it's just kind of almost too good to be true that this system, this natural system, lives up the road from Caltech.
So I have to ask, did you know that that was all there when you came to Caltech, or discover it after? What came first for you there?
So when I interviewed at Caltech, I thought maybe there was some chance that I would get the job. And I thought to myself, you know, this is my chance to, you know, extend my work outside the confines of the laboratory and, you know, get back to nature, as it were, and try to find some system that would take me out of the lab that I could study. And I knew that in this part of the world, these ants existed, and that there were kind of preliminary behavioral observations of some beetles that lived inside their colony. So the day after I interviewed, I took off and went to see if I could find these ants and these beetles. And it was really straightforward. You know, within 20 minutes, I found both of them. And this was, I think, February, which is, you know, one of the cooler months in Southern California. And that, all of that kind of suggested to me that this is a system that, you know, if I can find these beetles in decent numbers in February, then there's probably no seasonality, really. Maybe I could study these things all year round. And then the icing on the cake was I collected some of these beetles and ants and put them in a tube in my pocket. And when I was at the airport waiting to fly back to New York, which is where I was living at the time, I took the tube out of my pocket and looked at it. And sure enough, one of these beetles had climbed up on top of an ant and was grooming it in my pocket. And I thought to myself, well, that's an amazingly robust behavior that surely I could study in the lab. And I didn't know what it meant then. I didn't understand that what the beetle was doing was stealing the chemical profile from the ants. But surely, you know, this interspecies social interaction that was happening in my pocket, that was worthy of exploration. And sure enough, it's kind of turned into a major research theme in my lab.
And how long have you been there? How long has the lab been in operation? When did you put the lab together?
Yeah, I moved in 2017. And then my lab was kind of completed in 2018. And we moved into this purpose-built ant beetle laboratory, which is just a sort of dream come true.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to entomologist Joseph Parker, head of the Parker Lab at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, and we're exploring the fascinating world of beetles. We'll be back right after a short break. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with beetle expert Joseph Parker. Joe is an entomologist and head of the Parker Lab at Caltech in Pasadena, California. Well, back out to the field, I saw some video of just how many ants there are in these ant colonies, the velvet tree ants, that's what they're called?
That's right, velvety tree ants.
Velvety tree ants. There's just so many of them. How do you physically go about, you know, collecting them?
So, yeah, those ants are probably one of the largest colony-forming ants in North America. They're really poorly studied. You know, before us, very few people had worked on them at all. There's probably a few million workers per nest. And then we suspect that some of those huge colonies are actually components of larger what are called polydomous colonies, which is, you know, effectively a network of huge colonies across the landscape that are related to each other and show no hostility to each other. And so what you have to think about, if you've ever seen a kind of map of Los Angeles and the Angeles National Forest just north of it, you can really interpret this as, you know, humans dominating the southern part where all of the, you know, buildings are. But as soon as you get into that wilderness area in the Angeles National Forest, this one ant is really running the show. The entire forest floor is effectively parcelated up into these sectors that are patrolled by these single giant colonies. And they're really hives of activity of these myrmecophile beetles and other symbiotic species. This one ant is probably interacting with thousands of other organisms in this Southern Californian kind of native ecosystem. So it's really a keystone species. Now, to collect the beetles from these colonies, what we tend to do is pick up leaf litter from directly at the nest entrances where there are really high densities of ants. And you can sieve that leaf litter and you can use an aspirator, like a suction device, to pull out the individual beetles that are walking around. You also find the beetles walking along the foraging trails of this ant, which can extend probably a couple of hundred meters in radius from the central colony. And then sometimes you can reach inside these nests, and you get completely covered in ants when you do this, and pull out nest material. And sometimes you'll find the brood galleries. And these are hives of beetle activity too, because we think the beetles feeding on the brood inside the colony. So I think on a good day, you can go out and collect, you know, a couple of hundred beetles quite easily in a couple of hours.
Would there be a way to study the beetles inside an ant colony?
Yeah, well, we are trying to cultivate the ant in the laboratory and really kind of pared down setups into which we introduce the beetle. We've had some success doing this. In nature, you could imagine, you know, cutting some, you know, peephole into the nest to try and study the beetles, but it really is kind of frenetic, chaotic ant activity in there. So I think, you know, off the top of my head, I can't think of a really legitimate way to try and do that. Like, it's quite shocking sometimes when you kind of pull away part of a tree and expose the colony, and you just, you know, the ants pump out this alarm pheromone called sulcatone, which is really pungent. They're really, really aggressive. They'll bite you. You can easily get covered in large numbers of ants. And it always seems to be the case that it's always the kind of nastiest, most aggressive ants that have the most awesome beetles that live inside their colony.
yeah, that figures well. They have all those chemical defenses that they've employed over millions of years. You mentioned something, you know, speaking of chemicals, that I've always known, but I thought was very interesting about your beetles, is that, you know, when you watch ants, you know, in nature or even in your kitchen, they all follow a trail. And it's like, mm-hmm. that's for a reason, right? There's a right. chemical trail that they are yes. following, that they have secreted there to let everybody know this is where we're going. But the beetles, they can do that too. They follow that trail, don't they?
They're eavesdropping on those chemicals as well. This is the other side of the kind of behavioral ecology of these beetles. Not only are they using the ants' cuticular hydrocarbons as post-recognition information, but they are using the ants' chemical foraging trails, which is a different class of compounds called iridoids, and to disperse across the landscape. So the ants produce these trail pheromones from an abdominal gland and deposit these iridoids in these trails, and that's what the ants are following. Okay, and really the forest is a sort of network of these ant superhighways, which are based around these iridoid trails, and you'll find the beetles walking along those trails. And what you can do is actually extract these iridoids from ants and paint these chemicals in patterns. And you can put the beetle in an arena where you've drawn the a pattern of iridoids, and you'll see the beetle religiously following the chemical trail around.
Oh, wow.
And this is really, really important for the gene flow of these beetles. You know, if you're locked inside a colony, that's an evolutionary dead end. But by following these chemical trails across the landscape, the beetle can move out of the nest, never lose sight of their ants, and move into another nest. So we think this is very important for the long-term viability and persistence of these beetle populations.
And how did the beetles reproduce? Do they reproduce like in the ant colony?
It's actually ridiculous, the life history of these beetles. What we found is that it's really the adult stage, which is integrated inside the nest and symbiotic inside the colony, feeding on the brood, grooming the ants. But then what happens is females will leave the nest, and in the damp soil directly at the nest entrance, so he's talking right on the doorstep of the ants, they will deposit these gigantic single eggs. Now, these eggs take up the entire female abdomen, okay? And inside that egg is all of the ingredients to make a new beetle. So larvae will hatch out of those eggs, and we don't think the larvae even need to feed. They just kind of hang around in the soil, then they'll pupate, and then, you know, a fully formed adult will hatch out of the pupa and walk back inside the colony, groom an ant, and, you know, become integrated, and the cycle repeats this way. That's a very specialized reproductive strategy and life history, where really all of the acquisition of resources is happening in the adult stage. And you can, it kind of makes sense, right? The beetle larvae are soft-bodied. They're not very well chemically defended. They have very short limbs. It would be very hard for them to groom an ant. So the best thing to do is just hang out down in the soil, you know, off the ant's radar, and wait to pupate and become an adult, and then you can reintegrate into the colony.
Wow, that's amazing. And are there other cases of this kind of relationship between ant and beetle found throughout the world?
Yes. So what we've discovered for this beetle that lives inside colonies of the velvety tree ant appears to be basically true of many of these other lineages, which have evolved these obligate, you know, absolute dependencies on ant colonies. So very large colony forming ants, such as army ants in the tropics, they have beetles that are very similar to the ones that we study, which groom ants, again, presumably taking the cuticular hydrocarbons. They have this, you know, very specialized reproductive cycle where sometimes these beetles will look like the ant. They anatomically resemble the ants. It's incredible. And if you break open the kind of fake ant abdomen that these beetles have evolved, there'll be a single giant egg inside if the beetle is female. So again, we have predictable evolution happening at the level of the life history in these symbiotic lineages, which have independently evolved this way of life. So there's something very kind of stereotyped about what happens to the biology of these insects once they move inside ant colonies.
It's pretty amazing, you know, when I think about it, because the beetles have evolved a chemistry that works for them to live with the ants or defend themselves from it if they're the free roaming type beetles. And they've developed the behavioral patterns that allows them to integrate into ant society, if you will. And then some of them, like you said, they've actually evolved to kind of look physically like ants or have the kind of shape of an ant. And that's just astounding.
Yeah, and there are species that have moved into termite colonies and have evolved this really kind of inflated body form that mimics termites. So I think the rove beetle body is very malleable morphologically and can be kind of thrown into these different shapes, ant or termite-like shapes. And the reason for that is, we think, to mimic tactile communication. Okay, so ants that have these beetles that look like them inside their colonies are effectively blind or have very rudimentary visual systems. So they can't see these beetles, but nevertheless, the beetle looks like the ant. So why would the beetle look like the ant? Why would it look like a blind termite? Well, we think that these societies of social insects use a lot of tactile, so mechanical nestmate recognition mechanisms, as well as chemical ones. And so if you see how these ants interact with these anatomically mimicking beetles, they'll antennate the beetles. They'll touch their antennae over their bodies in much the same way that they do a fellow nestmate inside the colony. We think that they're actually surveilling the shape of the beetle, and it has to be ant-like enough to gain acceptance. So that is another aspect of the phenotype, the organismal properties of these beetles, which has evolved over and over again. a few years ago, we published a study that demonstrated that that ant-like shape has evolved at least 12 to 15 times independently in beetles that have moved inside colonies of tropical army ants. So again, it's this incredibly predictable pattern of evolution that happens in these symbiotic lineages.
And not to be too simplistic about it, but are there any kind of practical benefits down the road, perhaps, from learning all of this about beetle-ant chemical interactions and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to understand how an animal nervous system processes sensory information about other organisms in the world, which is something we're incredibly adept at doing, but really every animal has to navigate a living world filled with other species, then you can do no better than study the simplified brain of something like a rove beetle, which is so adept at performing these tasks of, you know, it detecting information from other species, classifying those other species as friend or foe, and executing behavioral programs that are adaptive, that enable them to interact in the right way with the other organism. So from the perspective of fundamental neuroscience, these beetles are a wonderful study system. The other dimension of their biology, which is very important, is their chemistry. So the chemically defended beetles, and also many of these symbiotic species that are able to produce behavior manipulating secretions, have really wonderful small molecule chemistries that we barely understand, but indicate that these beetles have evolved pretty sophisticated mechanisms to synthesize novel classes of compounds and evolve ways to contain those compounds, traffic them, and secrete them in ways which render their own cells intact. So if you're interested in how cells of animals are able to manipulate toxic small molecules, then again, you can do no better than study these beetles. And that's one of the dimensions of the biology of these beetles that I haven't really talked about today, which is how these defense gland cells have evolved this capacity to produce small molecule toxins, which are, you know, very nasty compounds. But the beetle has a highly efficient way of producing these things safely and secreting them outside of the body, and then repurposing these cell types, which they've evolved, that manufacture these chemicals, to produce novel secretions that can impact the nervous system of social insects in really interesting ways.
Can you give us some examples of some of those interesting ways?
Okay, so in the free-living beetles, they produce toxic benzoquinones as deterrents that activate pain channels in other insects. So when a free-living beetle bumps into an ant, it will secrete the contents of its chemical defense gland. And what we found in one of these other species that lives inside colonies of the velvety tree ant is that they've repurposed the cellular apparatus to manufacture benzoquinones to start producing other kinds of chemical, right? So these beetles, this particular beetle is called Limatoxinus. It produces totally different chemical classes called aromatic esters and terpenes from its gland. And now when this beetle bumps into an ant, it secretes this volatile kind of cloud around the ant that appears to intoxicate the ant. Okay, the ant no longer attacks the beetle. It actually stumbles around like this sort of inebriated, drunken mess. And that enables the beetle to, A, live close to the ants and get in and around their colonies. But also, and this is really kind of devious and manipulative, it feeds directly on these inebriated workers. So once they're kind of stumbling around in this kind of messy, intoxicated state, the beetle will just chomp its mandibles into them and start feeding on them. And the ant may recognize what's going on. And if that happens, the beetle leaks more of the secretion onto the ant to further intoxicate it. So it's a really brilliant reuse of this pre-existing chemical apparatus in the beetle's abdomen to enable this really kind of specialized symbiotic form of predation.
One last thing before you go. Is there like a favorite thing about your work that you just real quick, you could tell us that you love to do or particularly causes you joy?
I still like breaking into an ant colony and getting covered in ants and finding my quarry in the form of these spectacular insects. So I still accompany my students into the field. I'm still probably one of the better people at finding them, although everybody in the lab becomes, you know, pretty proficient at collecting these beetles. So that's one thing I still really, really enjoy. And I have to do to maintain, you know, my sense, the sort of visceral connection with these organisms. And the other thing that I like to do is I like to dissect these really tiny insects. So if you want somebody who can dissect chemical defense gland cells from the back end of a rove beetle that's 3 millimeters long, I'm still probably the person with the best motor control honed over almost 40 years of studying these beetles to do that. So I still have my uses in and around the lab.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, Joe Parker, it's been fascinating to find out more about the world of the beetles and the ants and your passion for researching this. It's been great to talk to you there, you know, there from Caltech at the Parker Lab, where you're an entomologist. You know, I've always loved the beetles, but you've taught me to appreciate, you know, beetles.
The real beetles. Yes.
The real thing. Yeah, the ones that aren't spelled, you know, with an A.
That's right. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
Thanks again to our guest, Joseph Parker, head of the Parker Lab in the Division of Biology and Biological Engineering at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. You can learn more about their work at beetles.caltech.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.